Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, comrades, to the Democrat Party, and now we will begin our national anthem. I see Comrade Chuck Schumer is beginning the flag-burning ceremony, and we are now coming out of the hamper because we have gained all the power in the world. Now appearing on stage is Comrade Clinton, and she is bringing her war victories, her medals that she won for the Battle of Benghazi, where she destroyed the Americans. Yes, and she was poor. She started very poor. And the fact that she is now worth $100 million means nothing. She is in sympathy with the poor. Standing on the stage platform now is Comrade Dick, Tricky Dick Turbin from Chicago, and Harry Reid, the cattle rustler from Nevada, and Carlos the Jekyll Levin from Munchkin. Yes, these are the best flag burners the Party of Death can present at this time, but we're breeding others like little babies. And now the document, better than the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, which is now banned, is being brought forward by Nancy Pelosi, and it's called the Obama Doesn't Care Bill. Yes, and Nancy Pelosi say, sign it, and then you can find out what's in it, sucker. And she is going to free the slaves. Yes, those poor slaves. Yes, the only slaves there are now are called taxpayers and tax suckers. And they will pay through the nose for what they have done to the communists in this country. And we are now presenting medals to the 48 senators who voted to burn the flag 40 days before 9/11, and 125 Viet Congress mice who also voted to burn the flag 55 days before 9/11. The heroes of the revolution, the ones who put it all on the line, as long as it belongs to you. Yes, comrades, our great men of the revolution. We are now in control. New York City has fallen to the communists. We now have a communist mayor running that tinhorn town. Yes, comrades, everything is coming up daffodils. Fantastic how we swept from out of 1945 to destroy the United States. And we did it with abortions and drugs, and everybody is happy. And now, with great pride, as I sign the document that will close all of the churches in the country, I now turn over the office of head executioner to our chief warrant officer and a Democrat. What's his name? Oh, by the way, we have two undercover agents planted in the Rhino Party. Yes, they are ours. They do what we say. You know this boozer, Bonnier, and what's the other guy? Match McConnell. He voted to burn the flag with us back 40 days before 9/11. But nobody knows that. They call themselves Republicans. Okay, I have issued the death warrant for anyone who speaks against the Communist Party. And we're proud to say we are opening gulags right here in the USA. And everybody will be happy or die. I conclude this meeting and I wish everybody much success as long as you pay your taxes. Welcome to the Spirit of America Party and the Spirit of America Party book. Christmas is upon us. The atheists are out there trying to shut us down and creating all kinds of chaos in the streets. And that's all part of a plan. So I'm going to smooth over the airwaves with a little Christmas music. And then I'll be right back. Thank you. When you're wrapping Christmas packages, that's good music. It puts you in the spirit of Christmas, unless you're not buying anybody anything. And there are people out there that do that. Under the pain of death, they do it. I'm reading O'Reilly's book on Patton, and they're talking about Joseph Stalin. And I just got to read you this. This is Svetlana, the daughter of Joseph Stalin. And it says, Svetlana once enjoyed Christmas Day a great deal. Her mother had been dead for 13 years. Natasha Aliluya simply went to bed one night and did not come down for breakfast in the morning. A maid found her alone in her bedroom. Isn't that a communist has a maid? How's that, huh? She was dead from a pistol shot, and a suicide note was visible on the nightstand. Natasha was 23 years younger than Stalin, a second wife to replace the one who had died from a typhus. Natasha, oh, let me see. Due to the dictator's long-standing proclivity for brutal rape, Natasha, incredibly, may have been his illegitimate daughter. Ooh. The devil knows whose daughter you are. Maybe mine, Stalin's once sadistically taunted her. The suicide was Natasha Aliyeva's final protest against the Soviet leader's nonstop cruelty and philandering, the bitter end to 14 years of abuse and neglect. When her mother died, the 5-year-old Svetlana knew nothing about her father's monstrous behavior. All she knew was that her mother was suddenly and mysteriously taken from her in the night. It would be years before she'd come to understand her father's evil disposition and begin to distance herself from his foul temper and hard drinking. Yet Joseph Stalin was devoted to Svetlana. He was a very simple man, very rude, very cruel, she will remember years later. There was nothing in him that was complicated. He loved me and wanted me to be with him. 4 years after Natasha's suicide, the Soviet dictator received the most curious party invitation. The year was 1935. Stalin was invited to a Christmas gala at the British Embassy in Moscow. Although he did not believe in Christmas, and communists do not, and never forget Karl Marx said religion is the yoke of the masses, but communism isn't. Stalin saw an opportunity aforesaid for Svetlana and maybe even for himself. Clearly, Stalin could not attend the Christmas party. The Russian people would never have understood. Atheism was the established philosophy in the Soviet Union and is reestablishing itself here in the USA. I just added that. Yet Stalin had celebrated Christmas as a boy back home in Georgia. Even though his tyrannical alcoholic father often beat him so severely that he urinated blood, young Joseph had a loving mother and knew the joy and warmth that came with the Christmas season. Yet when he died, he wouldn't go to a funeral and he called her a whore. Christmas remained important to Stalin as he became a young man. From age 15 to 19, he studied for the priesthood. He had always been rebellious and was only at the seminary because his parents forced him to attend. But still, he remained loyal to the church until the seminary raised its fees and Stalin turned his back on his faith. Gee, if they had given him a discount, they might have been raised, the country might still be Christian. That cold night in 1935, Stalin sent Svetlana across the river to the British embassy in his place, perhaps thinking that nothing more might come of it than a unique holiday experience. When she returned, Svetlana gushed about the presents and the wonderful decorations, and particularly the stately Christmas tree. It was the image of the tree that got to Stalin. Svetlana's description thawed his frozen heart. If the British could experience such a magical celebration, why couldn't the Soviet people? Of course, celebrating Christmas was still out of the question, but the ruthless dictator also realized that he could manipulate such a holiday to his advantage. So even though the date was fast approaching, Stalin decreed that January 1st would mark new annual celebration throughout the Soviet Empire. The people would not honor the birth of baby Jesus. The only religion in the Soviet Union was communism, and Stalin himself had demonstrated this in 1931 by ordering that the Christ the Savior Cathedral, a towering monument to Christianity, right in the heart of Moscow, be blown to bits. Who does that today? Who blows up churches today? Oh, Muslims do, don't they? And they attack statues of Buddha. No, the Russians would not celebrate the birth of Christ. Never instead would they celebrate the great moments of the Soviet Russia's 27-year-old history. We are coming up in 2017 on the 100th anniversary of the Soviet Empire, the Bolshevik Revolution, and Soviets, according to Jimmy from Brooklyn, always pay attention to dates. Like Jimmy told me that Earth Day is Lenin's birthday. How's that? You think the people that declared Earth Day knew about Lenin's birthday? You bet they did. Stalin arranged to have one of his top henchmen, Pavel Postishev, publish a letter in the state newspaper Pravda. That would be like Obama ordering the New York Times or the Washington Post or Time magazine. And, of course, the TV stations, always be communist, ABC, nothing but communist, NBC, the Communist News Network, CNN, and the Communist Broadcasting System, CBS. So, I mean, Stalin would order his Pravda, and Obama orders his Pravda. Such a letter changing Soviet state policy would never have been printed without Stalin's direct approval. The cover-up of the 2,347 Americans that Obama lost in Afghanistan, that was covered up under direct orders from the Obama regime. You never heard of one American being killed under Obama, unless it was Benghazi and it was too big to hide. But 2,347 Americans were labeled as NATO troops to be identified later, and later never came to do so. And for every 2,300, or every 2,000, let me round it out, KIAs, there's 14,000 wounded. It's 7-1. That's the ratio that I see. To do so would have been a crime punishable by death. Here they don't. They just don't grant them IRS status. So Pachiev, who just 2 years earlier had engineered a man-made famine to ensure the death of hundreds of thousands in the Ukraine, it was millions, clearly spoke for the Soviet dictator. In his letter, Pachiev spoke of a new Soviet holiday. Instead of Santa Claus, a white-bearded figure named Ded Moroz, Grandfather Frost, would travel across the Soviet Union in a sleigh pulled by three horses, delivering presents on New Year's Day instead of the Christ child. A youngster named New Year's Boy would be pivotal to the celebration. And, of course, there was the tree. No longer would the holiday tree be seen as religious dope and a savage custom, as it had been known throughout the Soviet Union. It is time to put an end to this wrongful condemnation of the tree. Stalin ordered by proxy, thanks to Postchev's letter to Pravda, children's New Year trees should be everywhere, in schools, orphanages. You see where he goes? You see where the communists go? Schools, orphanages, young pioneer clubs, cinemas and the theaters. You see where the communists go? Thus a holiday was born. Soviet toy factories began producing red stars. So that's the Soviet version of Yolka, the fir tree. They worship a tree. I was in Saudi Arabia with an Al-Qaeda wannabe. And it was a business relationship. And as he drove me to his house, he would stop at every mosque along the way and to show me how religious he was. And when he came back to the car, he would say, do you know what we do when we catch anybody drinking alcohol? I said, no. What do you do? He says, we take them in front of the mosque and we whip them. I said, my God, you would need a drink after that, wouldn't you? Yeah. So I said to him, in sharing religious thoughts, I said, suppose a man in darkest Africa never saw the Bible, never saw the Quran, was never outside his environment. And suppose he worshipped a tree. And because he worshipped the tree, he did good things. When he dies, will he go to heaven? What do you think he said? No. There's one God, it is Allah, and he's not going to heaven. How sad, huh? Okay, I'm going to give you a tune. When I come back, I'm going to tell you about the Christian version of Santa Claus. Okay, we're back. So who was St. Nicholas? And I got to do some research on St. Nicholas Avenue and how it got named. That's St. Nicholas Avenue's in New York City. I know there's a Convent Avenue, and that's named after St. Joseph's Convent on 125th Street. Because there used to be a lot of nuns down there. So, the true story of Santa Claus begins with Nicholas, who was born during the 3rd century in the village of Patara. At the time, the area was Greek and is now on the southern coast of Turkey. His wealthy parents, who raised him to be a devout Christian, died in an epidemic while Nicholas was still young. Obeying Jesus' words to sell what you own and give the money to the poor, Nicholas used his whole inheritance to assist the needy, the sick, and the suffering. He dedicated his life to serving God and was made Bishop of Myra while still a young man. Bishop Nicholas became known throughout the land for his generosity to those in need, his love for children, and his concern for sailors and ships. Under the Roman Emperor Diocletian, who ruthlessly persecuted Christians, Bishop Nicholas suffered for his faith, was exiled, and imprisoned. The prisons were so full of bishops, priests, and deacons, there was no room for the real criminals, murderers, thieves, and robbers. After his release, Nicholas attended the Council of Nicaea in AD at 325. The Council of Nicaea was a very important council, from what I've read about it. And I think the Emperor Constantine was involved in the Council of Nicaea. And they created... Hang in, I'm going to give you a tune. I got to take a phone call. So here we go. I don't have to take that phone call. Okay, so we were talking about the Council of Nicaea. In 325. At that time, the Catholic Church created, they used to have the Apostles' Creed, and then they created the Nicene Creed, which is an expression of what they believe in. And it's read by all of the parishioners at any Mass on Sundays or whenever they go to church. The interesting thing about Nicaea is in Turkey, and it had its name changed when the Muslims took over. And the town of Nicaea had an opportunity to convert to Islam or die for their faith. And they chose to die for their faith. And they were executed. And I believe their church in that town was turned into a stable for horses. So, we have martyrs too. Only our martyrs pray for salvation. We don't blow up neighborhoods and take innocent people with us. So, after his release, he attended the council in Nicaea in 325, and he died this day, December the 6th, AD 343. In Myra, and was buried in his cathedral church, where a unique relic called the manna formed in his grave. This liquid substance, said to have healing powers, fostered the growth of devotion to Nicholas. The anniversary of his death became a day of celebration, St. Nicholas Day, December the 6th. On the old Julian calendar, it was December the 19th. Through the centuries, many stories and legends have been told about his life and deeds, and these accounts help us understand his extraordinary character and why he is so beloved and revered as protector and helper of those in need. I remember reading this story before. Maybe I did some research a year or two ago, and it stuck in my mind. One story tells of a poor man with three daughters. In those days, a young woman's father had to offer prospective husbands something of value, a dowry. The larger the dowry, the better the chance that a young woman would find a good husband. Without a dowry, a woman was unlikely to marry. This poor man's daughters, without dowries, were therefore destined to be sold into slavery. On three different occasions, a bag of gold appeared in their home, providing the needed dowries. The bags of gold tossed through an open window are said to have landed in stockings or shoes left before the fire to dry. This led to the custom of children hanging stockings, so it goes back to 325. Eagerly awaiting gifts from St. Nicholas. Sometimes the story is told with gold balls instead of bags of gold. That is why three gold balls, sometimes represented as oranges, are one of the symbols for St. Nicholas, and so St. Nicholas is a gift giver. One of the oldest stories showing St. Nicholas as a protector of children takes place long after his death. The townspeople of Myra were celebrating the good saint on the eve of his feast day when a band of Arab pirates from Crete came into the district. They stole treasures from the church of St. Nicholas to take away as booty. As they were leaving town, they snatched the young boy, Basilios, to make into a slave. The emir or ruler selected Basilios to be his personal cupbearer. As not knowing the language, Basilios would not understand what the king said to those around him. So for the next year, Basilios waited on the king, bringing his wine in a beautiful golden cup. For Basilios' parents, devastated at the loss of their only child, the year passed slowly, filled with grief. As the next St. Nicholas feast day approached, Basilio's mother would not join the festivity, as it was now a day of tragedy to her. However, she was persuaded to have a simple observance at home with quiet prayers for Basilio's safekeeping. Meanwhile, as Basilios was fulfilling his tasks serving the emir, he was suddenly whisked up and away. St. Nicholas appeared to the terrified boy, blessed him, and set him down at his home back in Myra. Imagine the joy and wonderment when Basilios amazingly appeared before his parents, still holding the king's golden cup. This was the first story told of St. Nicholas protecting children, which became his primary role in the West. Another story tells of three theological students traveling on their way to study in Athens. A wicked innkeeper robbed and murdered them, hiding their remains in a large pickling tub. It so happened that Bishop Nicholas, traveling along the same route, stopped at this very inn. In the night, he dreamed of the crime, got up and summoned the innkeeper. As Nicholas prayed earnestly to God, the three boys were restored to life and wholeness. In France, the story is told of three small children wandering in their play until lost, lured, and captured by an evil butcher. And St. Nicholas appears and appeals to God to return them to life and their families. And so Nicholas is the patron and protector of children. And then there's stories about him on the sea. He was a young man. He sought the holy by making a pilgrimage to the Holy Land. There, as he walked where Jesus walked, he sought to more deeply experience Jesus' life, passion, and resurrection. Returning by sea, a mighty storm threatened to wreck the ship. Nicholas calmly prayed, and the terrified sailors were amazed when the wind and waves suddenly calmed, sparing them all. And so, St. Nicholas is also the patron saint of sailors and voyages. Other stories tell of Nicholas saving people from famine, sparing the lives of those innocently accused, and much more. He did many kind and generous deeds in secret, accepting nothing in return. Within a century of his death, he was celebrated as a saint, and today he is venerated in the East as wonder or miracle worker, and in the West as patron of the great variety of persons, children, bankers, pawnbrokers, scholars, orphans, laborers, travelers, merchants, judges, paupers, marriageable maidens, students, children, sailors, victims of judicial mistakes, like the guys that are rotten in Leavenworth, charged with premeditated murder, sentenced to 15 years in prison by officers that never had one day of combat experience. Yes. They need to pray to St. Nicholas. Perfumers, even thieves and murderers. He is known as a friend and protector of all in trouble or need. Sailors claiming St. Nicholas as a patron carried stories of his favor and protection far and wide. St. Nicholas chapels were built in many seaports, and his popularity spread through the Middle Ages. He became the patron saint of Apulia, Italy, Sicily, Greece, and Lorraine, France, and many cities in Germany, Austria, Switzerland, Italy, Russia, Belgium, and the Netherlands. And they got a list if you want to see it. Following his baptism, Grand Prince Vladimir brought St. Nicholas stories and devotion to St. Nicholas to his homeland, where Nicholas became the most beloved saint. Nicholas was so widely revered that thousands of churches were named for him, including 300 in Belgium, 34 in Rome, 23 in the Netherlands, and more than 400 in England. So, it's got another page. But basically, that's the St. Nicholas story. And maybe while we play you a little Christmas music, I'll look up and see how St. Nicholas Avenue got named for St. Nicholas. So, here we go. Thank you. I found the history of St. Nicholas Avenue in New York City. So this guy in 325, he affected a lot of people. St. Nicholas Avenue was named after St. Nicholas of Myra, patron saint of New Amsterdam since Dutch times. So, isn't that interesting? And they tell you how St. Nicholas Avenue used to be an old Indian path called Wequesqueak. An old Indian path. And that's what where our roads began, is old Indian paths. Interesting. Okay. We're going to give you a little light at Christmas, okay? And this is a very nice tune. Goes back to the 50s.
Of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know, where those treetops listen and children listen to hear sleigh bells in the snow, the snow.
Okay, we're back, and we're noticing that there, a lot of people are upset. They're upset about the demonstrations that are taking place, and of course, the media hypes them like crazy, man. Media loves bloodshed. It sells, I guess, and they're saying protests are breaking out all over the land, and then when you look at it, it's seven cities that have seven universities that are behind it. And so I figured it's time to introduce my party platform, the Spirit of America Party. And here's basically the tenets of SOAP, the Spirit of America Party. First off, we all have to admit that the Democrat Party is now the Communist Party. The proof is in the streets and colleges. Then we must admit that the Rhino Party is now the Democrat Party. Then we should launch two assaults, not on Obama and SS officer Heinrich Holder, but on the Democrats that gave them the power to destroy the nation. The second front should be opened up on rhinos, Mitch McConnell and Booz Boehner. They must be removed from power. I'm not saying completely remove them, but give them lesser positions. All they do is accommodate a communist president. We have a communist president. There's no two ways about it. His slogan is, any country but the one I pretend to come from. The second front must be opened. I said that already. Okay. The strongest assault must be against the Democrat Party of death and taxes. Do not allow the communists to take a penny on low gas prices. All they do is they get up in the morning and they roam the land looking for taxable benefits for themselves. None for the American people. Remember Obama's joke about shovel-ready jobs? $2 billion disappeared and he laughed about shovel-ready jobs. And I remember Robert Reich, a professor, telling a congressional hearing to make sure that none of the $2 billion goes to white construction workers. How's that? You're sitting in a country, all men are created equal. Now, if Robert Reich had said, make sure that none of that money goes to black construction workers, everybody would have been upset. But he said, white construction workers, so everybody shrugged. Atlas shrugs a lot nowadays. Okay. There's 8 cardinal rules for the Spirit of America Party. Rule number one, only one term per termite. Thank you and good luck. 2, $1 maximum champagne contribution. If the Chinese national government wants to donate $1 billion to support President Pinocchio Pants, he has to return it. He can only take a dollar. This way, Joe the Plumber is on equal footing with big governments donating big wads. 3, no lobbies. Get rid of all the lobbies. I don't care what they are. My favorite lobby, don't want it in Washington. Lobbies belong in a hotel at checkout time. 4, every American has to agree with me on this one. No federal, city, or state taxes over 40 hours a week. The first 40 hours are taxable, and then anything over that that you work in a given week is yours. 5, reduce government size and taxes by 80%. It can be done. It can be done. As sure as oil can go to $40 a barrel. If the politicians don't stop it. 6, raise military pay and all benefits and develop an IED pre-detonator. 7, should be in a car by himself at any time. There has to be 2 cops in every car. If that cop in Ferguson had another cop in that car, the bully might have stood down. It doesn't matter if a backup team was 90 seconds away. It doesn't matter. 2 cops in every car. Would you want to be a cop on a lonely road about 3 in the morning stopping a guy that's making a amphetamine run with a gun? Would you want to be that cop out there? Or would you want to be 2 cops that go home that night after the job is over? And if he shoots one and takes off, the other one at least can render assistance to his fallen comrade. So 2 cops in every police car. And all networks must play the Star Spangled Banner once a day. Pick the time, but we want to hear the tune. And Merry Christmas, everybody, and Happy Holy Days. So let me see if I can find a tune that's suitable for the Christmas season. Here's a nice one. That was pretty good, wasn't it? Here's some facts about the Garner case that a lot of people don't know. There is no doubt that Garner was resisting an arrest for illegally selling untaxed cigarettes. The issue wasn't untaxed cigarettes. The issue was the call came into a precinct that has a black precinct commander. And the complaint was the guy was disturbing the merchant's business in that shopping center. So he ordered a black woman sergeant to go and arrest the guy they were complaining about. And she took a team of about six guys, and they went there to make a collar, as they call it. Okay? And he resisted arrest, and he was wrestled to the ground. You cannot resist arrest. If Eric Garner did not resist arrest, the outcome of this case would have been very different, he told Newsmax. This is Kerrick, former police commissioner. He wouldn't be dead today. Regardless of what the arrest was for, the officers don't have the ability to say, well, this is a minor arrest. That policing commander wanted that guy off the streets, and they were following orders. So they can't say this is a minor arrest, we're just going to ignore you. The video of the July 17 incident clearly shows Garner, an African American, swatting away the arms of a white police officer seeking to take him into custody, telling him, "Don't touch me." Garner, 43, had a history of more than 30 arrests dating back to 1980 on charges including assault and grand larceny. At the time of his death, Garner was out on bail after being charged with illegally selling cigarettes, driving without a license, marijuana possession, and false impersonation. 5. The chokehold that patrolman Daniel Pantaleo put on Garner was reported to have contributed to his death. But Garner, who was 6'3" and weighed 350 pounds, suffered from a number of health problems, including heart disease, asthma, diabetes, obesity, sleep apnea. Pantaleo's attorney and police union officials argued that Garner's poor health was the main cause of his death. Garner did not die at the scene of the confrontation. He suffered cardiac arrest in the ambulance, taking him to the hospital, and was pronounced dead about an hour later. 7. Much has been said about the fact that the use of chokeholds by police is prohibited in New York City, but officers reportedly still use them. Between 2009 and 2014, the Civilian Complaint Review Board received 1,128 chokehold allegations. You should also know, and I don't know if they still teach it, but it used to be taught at the police academy as part of your training. Patrick Lynch, president of the New York City Patrolmen's Benevolent Association, said, "It was clear that the officer's intention was to do nothing more than take Mr. Garner into custody as instructed, and that he used the takedown technique that he learned in the academy when Mr. Garner refused." The grand jury began hearing the case in September 29 and did not reach a decision until Wednesday. So there is much testimony that was presented that has not been made public. The 23-member grand jury panel included 9 non-white jurors. In order to find Officer Pantaleo criminally negligent, the grand jury would have had to determine that he knew there was a substantial risk that Garner would have died due to his takedown. Less than a month after Garner's death, Ramsey Orta, who shot the most viewed videotape of the encounter, was indicted on weapons charges. Police alleged that Orta had slipped a .25-caliber handgun into a teenager accomplice's waistband outside a New York hotel. Okay, so there's some facts that you may or may not have known. I'm going to give you a real beautiful Christmas tune. It's in French.
Père, arrêtez le fou. Le Rédempteur a brisé toute entrave. La terre est libre et le ciel est ouvert. Il voit un frère où n'était qu'un esclave. L'amour unit ce qu'enchaîne le fait. Qui lui dira notre reconnaissance? C'est pour nous tous qu'il naît, qu'il souffre et meurt.
There were 723 comments on that article that I just read you, and this is from Newsmax. That's where the article originated. And here's, I'm going to just go down the line. Patrick, the media wants a civil war, which it hopes will bring it lots of airtime. They will only be taping their own fall when the shooting starts and a change of life for everyone. That's true. He knows what he's saying. You have three plans in life, yours, mine, and God's. Obama wants a civil war. This is by Sunshine Girl. And the media is igniting the fire, as most of the media have a political ties. And that's true, too. I told you, any lettered media that has a C and it stands for communist. I honestly believe that. They have no compassion for this country, and they have been at work in destroying it since at least Vietnam. Icepick says, yes, Obama wants civil war desperately. He craves attention, and the election stole that from him briefly. It is our misfortune that he discovered this for getting his fix. Wanderlust, plus he could stay in office. Jim C., we would have to go underground and hide if he did, and his idiots in charge with him. Oh, he would have to go underground and hide if he did, and his idiots in charge with him, or they would be the first ones to take a dirt nap. And GOP says, just like Hitler, a Phoenix, a 247, says, my CIA connection told me that O and his minions have already concocted a contingency to move the government to Iceland once the civil war begins so they can watch it on TV, just like Benghazi. Not far away, Obama should go to Antarctica would be better for us. And the next guy says, and you to hell, never to be missed. Hey, how, and then another guy says, well, how about that for a cogent? Well thought out response from the Obama file. Hasn't he twisted everything he touches into a knot enough to suit you? Another guy says, running out of foil these days. And Kilmaloran says, Iceland is an independent country, not a U.S. territory or free parking. That story sounds like BS to me. Krazor says, Iceland does not make up the entirety of the Arctic Circle. Stupid. See how they squabble. They don't stick to the point. They all got to squabble. Your connection at the CIA is a guy who what? Cleans the toilets. Pendant Citizen says, janitors and custodians know a lot more than you think. Oh, I'll tell you who knows a lot more than anybody thinks. Waiters and busboys. They see and hear stuff that just typically keep their mouth, they just typically keep their mouth shut. Waiters and busboys and waitresses. Only if he has the military backing, which he is not sure of at this time, or he would have pulled it off already. This is something to think about. When he orders the American military to fire on their brothers, uncles, and cousins, what are they going to do? Then you got a real civil war on your hands. And all bets are off. And the enemy is just going to sit out there and kill the winner. And the Russians know how to do it better than anybody else. They told the Poles they were coming in to rescue them from the Germans to rise up, and the Poles rose up, and they sat back and let the Germans kill them all. And then they went in and killed the Germans and took over the country. The Poland that started World War II, England went to the aid of Poland to free Poland. And at the end of World War II, Poland was still a slave country, only this time instead of to Germany, to the Soviet Union. One socialist country won. And the Russians are the masters of using people. You just got to look in the streets. Obama got rid of most of the senior officers that did not toe his line. Why do you think Sharpton and company are creating all these demonstrations nationwide? It's really not nationwide. It's seven cities, and they have been the flames of communist revolution are attributable to seven universities. Why is it that within 24 hours of any incident involving a minority breaking the law, Al Sharpton is always there, then comes Jeremiah Wright, and Jackson, Jesse Jackson, Oprah, and finally Obama himself? Yeah. Wouldn't surprise me if Sharpton and his gang have a direct line to Obama's office. There are plenty of black police that Obama could meet with. Sharpton and his gang have been locking for years to having national demonstrations. Thanks to Obama and Holder, they have succeeded. Obama needs to be removed from office. Impeachment takes too long. I got to tell you, if you're going to do anything, you got to do it legally. And you're not going to, you probably won't win. But you know what? Don't hesitate to do it, because at least you'll slow him down. And he's on a crash course to destroy this country. Kilmaloran says, just once I'd like to see Sharpton, Obama, Jackson, Holder take sides and investigate when a non-minority individual, preferably an unarmed young male, is shot dead by the police with provocation, or even with provocation. The pantheon of Obama, Sharpton, Jackson, and Holder are trying to convince the world that only minority men suffer from excessive force and killing at the hands of the police. Tell that to John Rana, the 94-year-old white World War II vet, after being shot five times in the abdomen with beanbags at close range from menacing the Chicago police with a cane. There was something that, oh, de Blasio got up and made a speech about how he's got to caution his son how to be careful in the city. Every father gives his son caution about being in the city. And it's not necessarily about police. It's just survival of the fittest. I'm going to play for closing a tune called The Streets of New York. and it's about a young man who comes to New York City from Ireland, and as he's packing to get to the boat, his father is telling him how to be careful because people would cut you for the coat on your back or the watch that you got from your mother. Okay? And de Blasio, big Bill de Blasio, should have to take down a guy like Garner. He should have to make that arrest and show us how he would do it with his backup team. Show us how he would do it. Lieutenant Scrounge, which might be the reason why he's gutting the military. He's cutting it to a size it hasn't been before World War II. And then what happened? Pearl Harbor. And we had to scramble to catch up. Do you know, I do have visions of an instant draft. When the Germans during World War I were on the outskirts of Paris, every able-bodied Frenchman was rounded up from the cafes and the Moulin Rouge and put in taxi cabs and sent to the front as they were. And don't think that couldn't happen here, because the next war is going to be very fast and very furious. And they may have a draft with no basic training. Oh boy, wait till you see the marathon to the Canadian border that day. Don't forget that a Democrat in the White House let World War II happen. Democrats get you into war and they leave you to die on the battlefield, promising never to run again. And Benghazi is a typical example. Well, Obama was supposedly born in Hawaii. Could be related. I guess the conspiracy theory would be that he is trying to recreate Pearl Harbor. Except this time it would be the U.S. that surrenders. If you read these statements very carefully, you will see Obama's fingerprints are all over this case. Point number 8. The grand jury was held over until the Democratic state of New York had got the result that they were looking for. I watched this video very carefully, and the only conclusion I can come to is that this was not an arrest, it was an execution. Newsmax needs to get their facts straight. Point number 6, Garner was dead on the scene. He did not move ever again on his own power after he said for the last time, I can't breathe. How many times did he say that? 11? Well, why don't you practice saying I can't breathe 11 times and tell me how many breaths you take. So, and DMS replied to Phoenix 247. Phoenix 247. You need to look at the video more than once and watching the truth, not concocting up your own version of what happened. You talk about what's right? Well, guess who is spinning their own yarn about all of this? Number 1, it's a true shame that this happened. Number 2, yes, I think excessive force was used. Number 3, when one is surrounded by 6-7 police officers in a 180-degree semicircle against the wall, 6'3", 350-pound individual would have a hard time running away. Garner did have a criminal record, and the police and the media, if they did their truth-finding search right, knew it. There was no chokehold. Look at the video. Garner is 6'3", 350 pounds. Officer Pantaleo was 5'10", 175 pounds. It's easier to say to you, look up the definition of chokehold than to write the whole meaning. Or the, and then Seymour. Okay, yeah. Anybody that says excessive force was used has to explain how they would do it. What would they have done differently to arrest that man? Okay. We're almost out of time, and I'm going to give you a tune about a New York City cop. Listen to the words very carefully.
I was 18 years old when I went down to Dublin with a fistful of money and a cartload of dreams. Take your time, said me father, soft of a Russian like hand. Remember all is not what it seems to be. For the spellers would put you for the coat on your back, or the watch that you got from your mother. So take care, be young bucko, and mind yourself well when you give this sweet note to me, brother. At the time Uncle Benji was a fleet man in Brooklyn, me father, the youngest, looked after the farm. When a phone call from America said send the lad over, the young fella said sure it wouldn't do any harm. For I spent my life working in this dirty old ground, while a few pints of porter and the smell of a pound. Sure, maybe there's something you'll learn, I'll see, and you can bring it back home. Make it easier. So I landed at Kennedy on a big yellow taxi, carried me and me back through the streets and the rain. Well, me poor heart was thumping around with excitement. I hardly even heard what the driver was saying. We came in the short pathway to the flatlands in Brooklyn, to my uncle's apartment on East 53rd. I was feeling so happy, I was humming a song, and I sang, you're as free as a bird. Well, to shorten the story, what I found out that day was that Benji was shot out in an uptown parade. And while I was flying my way to New York, poor Benji was lying in a cold city bar. Well, I phoned up the old fella, told him the news. I could tell he could hardly stand up in his shoes. As he told me, go ahead with the plan, but not to forget the proud Irish man. So I went up to Nellie's, he sighed for a road, and I started to learn about lifting a load. But the heaviest thing that I carried that year was the bitter sweet heart of my hometown so dear. I went home that December, cause the owl full of died. Had to borrow the money, bumped it on the side. And all the bright flowers of the grass couldn't hide the poor wasted face of the father. I sold up the old vineyard for what it was worth. Into my bag took a handful of bread. And I boarded a train, and I caught me a plane, and I found myself back in the U.S. again. It's been 22 years since I set foot in Dublin. The kids know to use the correct knife and fork, but I'll never forget the green grass and the rivers as I keep law and order on the streets of New York.
That's it, folks. Have a nice night. Have a nice weekend. And pray that the Washington Redskins punish the Rams for their sins.